Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
Post-HIV diagnosis, I think stigma has changed. It's now lack of understanding, it's poor education, it's projection of your feelings onto someone else.
At what point along that conversation, within that maybe those couple of hours or however long it was it made known to you and you were able to absorb the scientific reality of what was to come?
I rang my mum as soon as I got out of the clinic, and obviously my mum was around for this Don't Die of Ignorance campaign, and I was like, I have to convince my mum I'm going to be okay. And it's through convincing all of these people that you slowly convince yourself.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for downloading us. Thanks for streaming us as well. Have we appeared in any of those Spotify adverts that sort of tell you how much you've been listening? If Mental Health Monday appears in your Spotify Unwrapped, or do send me a message on Facebook or on Twitter, Instagram or LinkedIn. That would absolutely make my day. Data capture has never been more fun than Spotify Unwrapped. The podcast is about normalising conversations about mental health. It's about tackling the stigma. And thank you to everybody who wants to get involved in the podcast. I've had loads of offers heading into Christmas and the new year for people to get involved in the podcast, recommend guests for the podcast, recommend themselves for the podcast. And I absolutely love it when people do that, particularly those people who say, I think we can have a conversation that would be beneficial to a wider audience. And I think if we can do that, that's absolutely what the podcast is about, particularly when it puts people's own experiences front and centre. I think that's when it's most relatable, and I hope to think that that's what we can do here on the programme, and it's what we've done so well for so long. It's what we will continue to do in 2022. There is a link to my email across my social medias. You can get involved on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and on LinkedIn even. I'm either Mick Coyle or Mr. Mick Coyle. You'll see a picture of me. Tall bloke with glasses, that's me. Get involved, love to hear from you. Let's get some dates booked in for the new year for some more brilliant guests. Today on the programme, we're going to talk about stigma. Stigma is a word which comes up all the time in mental health conversations, but it's actually also a word which came up in a lot of conversations I was having last week as part of coverage for World AIDS Day. Now, people living with HIV in the UK at the moment have got a story to tell. And that is not the story that you heard in the 1980s and the 1990s. It is not about a death sentence. That is not the story that you may have heard about on TV, that you may have seen on your screens, that you may have picked up as you were growing up through the 1980s and 1990s. It simply isn't the world that we're in anymore. Science and medicine has moved on incredibly in this field, to the point where people living with HIV now can take one or two pills a day, and it can suppress the virus, the viral load in the body, so much that actually it becomes undetectable. And when you're undetectable, it's untransmittable, which means that you can't even pass it on. What an incredible advancement that is, that people can go on to live normal, he said in quote marks, normal, healthy lives. I don't know what a normal life is, but you can live as long as somebody who is negative, even if you are someone who is positive. But this U equals U, untransmittable and undetectable, it's incredible. It's one of those things which completely, you almost should be celebrating it from the rooftops in a world that we grew up in where this was a don't die of ignorance campaign. Now people are living, they're living a long time, but there's a switch. And the switch is this, that now, because people still have stigma around HIV and the word AIDS, the stigma becomes dangerous again because they don't get tested. They don't get educated. They don't find out about what life is really like now, how the science has moved on. And as a result, they might be living with an illness which might ultimately cause them problems because they haven't been tested, that they don't get on the medication and they don't manage to get the treatment that will give them that long and healthy life. So there's a danger that the stigma actually ends up costing lives, while at the same time, that stigma also impacts the lives of people who are living with HIV, because people, when they meet them, are maybe scared to shake a hand. Maybe they don't want to share a bathroom with someone who's got HIV because they think that it can be passed on through a handshake or through sharing a toilet. And of course it can't. That's not the way it works. But if you're not educated, you don't know. And if you are living in fear of an illness of which we should no longer fear, then actually that the misinformation, the myth, continues to swirl around when it doesn't have to anymore. I spoke to a guy this week who said to me, we live in space age times, but with stone age minds. And I thought, what a brilliant way to summarize how far we've come scientifically, and yet socially, we're still way, way, way behind. So we're going to talk about stigma today. We've got George Westwood with us on the program. George is a brilliant guest. George's living with HIV. He's going to talk about his diagnosis when he was at university and the reality of what life is like if you're living with HIV. And I think having this conversation will help people get an understanding of how normal it is. Again, normal in quote marks. And at the same time, get a sense of what that stigma is and how out of place and how unnecessary that stigma is, given what we now know scientifically and medicinally about living with HIV. Stigma is a word we know a lot about in the mental health world, so it's important to talk about it and continue to break it down wherever we see it. What does stigma mean to George, though? Let's start off by talking about that as we continue with another episode of Mental Health Monday.
I think stigma for me is, pre-HIV, stigma just sort of meant this dislike of something or anger towards or not positive feelings towards something. I think post-HIV diagnosis, I think stigma has changed massively. My understanding of stigma's changed. It's now lack of understanding. It's poor education. It's projection. It's a projection of your feelings onto someone else.
I think it's so interesting that the sort of you see it as a sort of before and after there. Particularly when we're talking about HIV, I wonder whether or not, you know, if someone talks about a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding, and someone says HIV, if you were to say, write five words on a wall that associate with HIV, among the general population, I think largely there'd be negative connotations. One of them also almost certainly would be AIDS. Another might be potentially Freddie Mercury. And I wonder how many of those references or understandings fall back to a period of time in potentially probably the 1980s and the 1990s in terms of our understanding.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think AIDS would definitely come up, Freddie Mercury would definitely come up. And it goes back to the idea that in the 80s and 90s, when we had this quote-unquote AIDS crisis, when hundreds and thousands of people were dying from AIDS back then, that's where our knowledge came from. We had big public health campaigns. I'm sure everyone remembers the tombstone. That's what is stuck in everyone's minds. It was don't die of ignorance. It was don't catch this illness and don't let it kill you, which is what was happening. It was true back then. And that was the public health campaign. But science has come such a long way since the 80s and the 90s, as I'm sure we're all aware. We've just lived through a pandemic and we've seen how science reacted to that. And science has reacted in the same way to HIV. Now people living with HIV live long, healthy lives. They have access to treatment. They can't pass the virus on. But our social understanding is still in the 80s and 90s. It's Freddie Mercury telling us that he had AIDS before he died. It's people dying on deathbeds. It's people being locked away as they were in COVID isolation. And I like to say that people living with HIV have a social diagnosis. They're not medically diagnosed anymore. It's not like it was back then. But they're socially diagnosed because of what you just said, this shame, this stigma, this sort of stay away from people living with HIV. But it's not the case at all.
There's sort of an echo. You mentioned that COVID is a crisis as well. There's something of an echo in that 1980s campaign. If you think about it, you know, a whole sort of government rotating around a particular issue, having adverts and leaflets going through every door, really hard-hitting messages about this sort of unknown virus going around that obviously came from a good place, similar with the COVID sort of crisis that we've seen recently. Whereas at the same time, long-term, people are now thinking about what are the social consequences of, in COVID's case, the lockdowns and people staying away from each other for such long periods of time. And obviously there's a legacy to that tombstone advert as well, which was kind of unforeseen at the time. And you'll be kind of too young to have experienced it, I imagine, first time round. But it is quite strange to think that there was that thing, which was ultimately was coming from a good place, that there was this warning. Obviously has this legacy now, which the next generation and the generation of that are now having to sort of live with.
For sure. I think we can't underestimate how even the HIV community itself now on reflection is grateful for that sort of that public health campaign. It saved lives. There's no doubt about it. I think, again, it's this social diagnosis we've lagged, though. It's the public health campaigns what we remember. And as you say, you sort of look back on it through gritted teeth. You are very grateful for it, but you wish it's unintended consequences. I think when we shouldn't necessarily compare AIDS and COVID together, but what I think you can compare is public health and how serious populations take health. People take health very seriously when we talk about it loudly enough. And I think that sort of echoes why there's still a stigma today, because people still have in their heads that HIV and AIDS is a killer. They take their health seriously, so we shame it. I'm not saying shame is the correct response to any sort of health issue, but that's what happened, and that is what is happening today. And I think that's why we have World AIDS Day. We have World AIDS Day to sort of commemorate and remember those that we've lost to AIDS, but we also do it as an education tool and an awareness raising tool. It's trying to get these messages out that people living with HIV in the West can access medication and live healthy lives, and there's nothing to be afraid of. But we've still got so far to go as well. Do you know what I mean? There's countries around the world who people are still dying of AIDS. It is still an epidemic, and we should be aware of that. It shouldn't just be chucked into the history books, because we're still living through it now.
Can we talk about sort of your own circumstances as well? The moment of diagnosis, I guess, is when that any personal sort of either information, education or stigma awareness, whatever words we want to put in there, sort of confronts you head on. I just wonder whether you can maybe take us to the circumstances in which you find out about a diagnosis, and just what that looks like, sounds like, feels like as that information starts to become absorbed.
Yeah, for sure. I was 19 years old when I was diagnosed with HIV, so it was nearly 5 years ago. It was just over 4 years ago. I was in my first year of university, and I went for a routine health checkup, sexual health checkup. I did an at-home test. It came back inconclusive. Knowing what I know now, I know that that meant that the test was positive. I didn't know that at the time. I just thought it was a routine sexual health checkup. And they say the four words, you are HIV positive, and the easiest way to describe it through complete lack of understanding of HIV at the time myself was in the movies when something's happening and everything, you just hear a ringing tone and nothing's going in, and your mind is, you don't know where you're at. And I just remember sitting in a room and being by the most loveliest nurse and doctor I've ever met in my life, just being told lots and lots and lots of information, but sort of them times you can't take it in, you know, you're sat there and you think, what have I done? What's happened to my life? Am I going to die? They're the sort of questions you're asking yourself. I convinced myself within those couple of hours in that room that I probably wasn't going to be around within the next week, never mind the next 10 years that they're telling me that it's absolutely fine. It's hard, and I do blame that on I blame my experience on a lack of understanding and not having sort of the education around HIV. It's really difficult as a gay man to be told to act rationally to a HIV diagnosis when it's the one thing you tell gay men to avoid at all costs. You can't expect someone to act rationally in that situation, and it definitely wasn't a rational onboarding of a HIV diagnosis.
What was the point in terms of that, the high-pitched noise and the sort of information flying around your head? At what point along that conversation within that, maybe that those couple of hours or however long it was it made known to you and you were able to absorb the scientific reality of what was to come? And what was being told to you at the point that you could absorb it about actually what the reality of what the next 10 years would look like?
So I was diagnosed in an era of U equals U, which is undetectable equals untransmittable. I was never part of the cohort of diagnoses that had to receive messaging that wasn't that. U equals U is a sort of a very scientific term. And as I say, when you've got ringing in your head and someone says U equals U, you don't take that in straight away. I don't think it was in that room that I started to take in them the scientific knowledge and the science and the you're going to be fine. My best friend actually came into the room because the nurse and doctors were quite concerned about my reaction, and they needed someone to be able to listen and take this information in. I think it was when I went home, and you sort of give yourself a slap on the cheek and say, right, come on, you've got to do this. And I was handed books upon books and leaflets of managing your HIV and managing your sexual health and living happily with HIV and all of these different things. And it was the internet, and it was watching other experiences and watching sort of videos and going on social media and searching about HIV. It was that sort of reading other people's stories, I think, is what really makes you think, oh, I can live well with HIV. It doesn't happen overnight, of course, but it happened. I'd say it happened quite quickly.
I was going to say, can you talk me through that moment? Because that's obviously, there must be a time you suddenly think, oh, hang on a minute. My reaction to this, I'm not saying it's an OTT reaction, because of course you can react any way you want, but maybe my reaction to this isn't really based on the reality of it. What, can you talk me through that sort of moment, and then what starts to go through your mind, that where you start reading about U equals U, about untransferables and undetectables, and you start hearing about people living long and healthy lives, as long and as healthy as people who aren't HIV. So talk me through that, because that must be almost quite mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. I think what happened with me was I didn't allow myself to believe it, but I knew I had to say it. So when I was telling other people, and I told people quite quickly, I told my university flat, I'm a very open book. I told them when I got home, bearing in mind there are people I still class as best friends now, but I'd known them for 4 months at the time. And I rang my mum as soon as I got out of the clinic. And obviously my mum was around for this Don't Die of Ignorance campaign. I think the way it happened was I took in all this information and I was like, I have to convince my mum I'm going to be okay. My mum, I'm 3 hours away from my mum. She can't possibly think that her son is in danger. So let's convince mum first. And it's through convincing all of these people that you slowly convince yourself. And it is, it comes back to what we said right at the start. It's this stigma. I realized that without even knowing it, I had deep-rooted stigma about HIV. Even though I wasn't around in the 80s and I sort of didn't have a comprehensive sex education on HIV, but I had deep-rooted stigma. I believed people with HIV and AIDS die. You know, growing up in the sort of the school playground, you hear AIDS jokes, and it's a common part of growing up being gay. It shouldn't be, but it is. And you hear these words thrown at you, so you think, stay away from it. The point of realizing that you are going to be fine, it's equally sort of magnificent. It's sort of, wow, I'm fine. But it's also sort of upsetting and annoying in the way that it's, well, why are we letting not just young people, but anyone be diagnosed with HIV and have these preconceived ideas about it before? I think it's why sort of the crowd of people living with HIV can be so noisy, because we're sick of it. We need comprehensive sex education. We need sort of, people need to know the facts about HIV. It's why we talk on World AIDS Day. It's why we talk about HIV.
do you have an official, you don't have to declare it on a piece of paper, a prognosis, if you like. What is it your doctor or GP, your clinician says to you about what life will be like for you?
My life will be the exact same as someone who isn't living with HIV, and I think that's the beauty of it. That question has been asked, what is your prognosis? I don't have one. I don't know. I can't read into the future. It's like me asking someone who isn't living with a condition, what's your prognosis? I don't know. I might get hit by a bus tomorrow. I might live till I'm 101. I think we could go into a whole conversation about sort of, I go and get my blood done every 6 months. My doctors are finding, like, I'm arguably might live longer than someone without HIV, because if my, say, for example, my cholesterol drops or raises really quickly, sort of it's picked up in 6 weeks, at 6 months, sorry. I have these constant checkups. My medication isn't toxic to my body. I'm fine. I don't have a prognosis. I don't know.
I didn't necessarily think that it would be on a piece of paper, but I you've answered it very well. Is it one tablet a day?
That you take? So Yeah, so I take one tablet a day. I take it once a day, one tablet a day. I don't think about it. I just take it. Don't get me wrong. Sort of at the start, there might have been sort of a psycho side of taking medication which played on you, and it was like, I've got to take medication for the rest of my life. Now I live well with HIV. It doesn't affect me. Some people take two tablets a day, but we live in a world where there's so many different combinations of drugs that people might say, well, what if the drugs don't work? And it's like, but there's so many different combinations now that they will work. And science is amazing. We're moving towards sort of injectable treatments, and some people don't have to take drugs every day because they live well with HIV on injectables, for example. So yeah, it's an exciting time on treating HIV.
It's interesting that journey, George, you've spoken through of, you know, your own sort of growing up, your thoughts there, then your own diagnosis, and then sort of sharing that with people and overcoming the questions and the hurdles. I wanted to ask you now, in terms of that stigma, presumably, you mentioned the prognosis or not prognosis, that now you are expecting to live, watch out for the buses, by the way, a long and healthy life, and that's absolutely fantastic. What I wanted to touch on maybe next, George, is when it comes to stigma and general society, how often is it that your HIV status comes up in either a conversation or there's a medical register and you've got to declare something and your status has to become known within a certain environment? And I just wanted to sort of maybe explore what those sorts of times were, what those situations kind of look and sound like, and maybe how that stigma still impacts your life, even though you've obviously moved on to this place where you're much, where you yourself know all about what the realities of it are.
I think, so we live in a time now where showing your HIV status, you don't have to do it in any situation. Under the Equality Act of 2010, HIV is classed as a disability. You do not have to disclose it under any circumstance. I have had times where I have shared it and have faced stigma. I wouldn't say it happens in the day-to-day life. It's not like I walk around sort of with a little flag, like, I have HIV, stay away, or whatever. But there is situations where you feel like it's right to do it. So, for example, in sort of cosmetics, so tattooing, piercings, I've been refused a tattoo. I've also been refused piercings before. That's because they ask you on questionnaires before you get sort of your piercings and tattoos whether you are living with HIV. And I am living with HIV and I'm not ashamed of it, so I'm not going to say no. I could, and it would be perfectly legal to do that, but I'm not going to. I feel like I talk about my HIV. There's some people in this world who aren't lucky enough to be able to live openly and confidently with HIV. It would be an injustice to them for me to tick no. That isn't the case for everyone, but that's how I feel about it. And being refused sort of them treatments, the worst one was I wanted a tattoo to sort of celebrate my HIV journey and celebrate how far I'd come. And I was refused. And it takes you right back to that sort of initial diagnosis. It takes you right back to I am living with an illness that people are scared of. And they can justify it in any way they want, but it's not justifiable. It takes you back to that sort of dark corner of the room, sitting in the shower, crying, cleaning yourself because you think you're dirty. It takes you right back to them memories of HIV, and they're not nice memories. I would say, I think the more you live with HIV, I now work in the HIV sector, I see stigma all the time. I think you get better at handling it, but it doesn't mean it's easy as a 19-year-old who's trying to juggle all of the other things that life throws at you as a teenager.
Can I ask you about that? And that's a really interesting sort of aspect to that story, that you thought, I mean, for me, that's a really life-changing thing, to get a tattoo. It's like a life-defining thing, something that's going to stay with you. You obviously had that in mind as something which you wanted to sort of record or sort of highlight that journey. Can you talk me through what that conversation was like? Because that must have been quite upsetting to think, I'm going to do something that represents this journey I've been on, and yet the very stigma which you have been able to overcome prevents you from doing the thing you wanted to do to represent the journey you've been on.
Precisely. I got over the self-stigma to face another brick wall of stigma. The conversation was I was agreed. It was agreed that I could have the tattoo. This was before sharing my HIV status. They said I could. I paid my deposit. And I can't remember if I went in or if I had a phone call, but it was a phone call, and I essentially rang them just to say, look, I think you should know that I'm living with HIV. But universal precautions, like, everything is fine. Like, there is no risk of transmission here. But you're working with blood, so I think you should know. And they turned around and said, no, you can't have it. We aren't comfortable tattooing you. And I think they blamed it on insurance purposes, which, again, it's all this, like, big, complex, like, multifaceted world of, like, what is the issue here? Is it stigma? Is it insurance? Is it precautions? Is it health? Like, what is it? But it's stigma. And, yeah, it was a tricky conversation to have. But I think, as I said, you shut down. I wasn't in sort of the mindset to educate. It wasn't, I'm not going to sit here on the phone and tell you U equals U and can't pass it on, because that's on you. It's on you as someone who runs a tattoo parlor to know about blood-borne viruses, and you're working with blood every day. And I think more fool you for not knowing, not more fool me. And now I'm in the mindset of, I don't want to be tattooed by someone who doesn't know that someone living with HIV can't pass it on, because ultimately, the people that are ticking no on that form perhaps don't know their status. And actually, the people who aren't on effective treatment and aren't getting tested for HIV are a risk to the tattooists, not the people living with HIV or on treatment and can't pass it on.
Yeah, it's an insurance thing. It sounds like the sort of thing you would say when you couldn't really quite be sure. Because no one's going to go, oh, well, pass me the number of the insurance company, I'll ring them up and I'll, excuse me, clause X1234. Yeah. Like, no one's ever going to do that. But no, it's, and that's such a shame. Have you managed to get a tattoo since? Have you managed to?
So I've been refused two, and I've sort of just not tried. I know I could get one now. I parked the idea of getting one for my HIV status, but I've been refused two, and I think you just sort of, it's not, sometimes battles aren't worth fighting, Mick. Sometimes it's like, I don't know if I want to fight that battle. I will get another tattoo, and I've had countless tattoo artists telling me that they will tattoo me. But no, I haven't had one yet.
Do you know, can you tell us what it was? Has the plan changed over the years? Have you thought, oh, well, I'm glad I didn't get it the first time round?
Well, it's funny that we say that, because I was refused it and wasn't very happy about it. But I'm sure I'd love it if I had it, but I don't want that anymore. I wanted it was a sunset over a horizon. It's a sunrise, not a sunset. But potato, potato. And it was a sunset just to sort of signify, like, the horizon is there. You can see like there is brightness, sort of like light at the end of the tunnel, to signify that, like I said, coming past that self-stigma, coming past that, I'm going to be okay. Yeah, that's what the tattoo was going to be.
Good stuff. Well, I look forward to see whatever it is in the future, George. I'll be following you on Instagram now to see, when's he going to get there? The tattoo. It's good to hear that actually other tattooists who kind of know what they're doing are kind of going, oh, yeah, I can do that for
yeah,
you.
Which for sure.
I suppose gives you those little, talk about summer, those little chinks of light coming through that make you think, oh, actually, maybe. And this is very much the case within the mental health world as well, isn't it? There's sometimes you get the little chinks of light that come through and you think, oh, maybe we are getting somewhere. Maybe this is a conversation which is starting to cut through. Do you get those moments where you think, yeah, okay, we're getting somewhere here?
I do. And I think I come from an experience living as a gay man. I think that the thing I would really echo is, or like look back on and sort of criticise a little bit, is that all of the tattooists who have offered to do me a tattoo are LGBT tattooists. They're people working in these queer spaces. And I think what that does is it drills down that HIV is a gay disease, and it's not. Anyone can be affected by HIV. HIV doesn't discriminate. It's tattooists in these high prevalence areas where heterosexual men and women are living with HIV. They need to know too. That doesn't mean that we aren't, like, we, of course, we're moving forward slowly. sort of, I now work for the National AIDS Trust and I work on HIV policy, and we're seeing sort of last World AIDS Day. So a year ago today, when now anyone in the armed forces can serve who are living with HIV, it's getting into these circles that probably don't typically talk about HIV. And I think that's what we've got to do. We've just got to keep chipping away. And I think the cultural and the social diagnosis aspect of it will catch up. It just takes time. And it doesn't happen overnight. I just wish it was happening faster than it is.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that actually those issues within the wider world, if you go, oh, by the way, people with HIV serving in the military, they'll go, well, why was it not been possible? And I guess that there was a rule that was probably written in 1987 or something like that, and then that rule never got changed. But I imagine if you get into a room with people and you can go, okay, well, this is the information, then it becomes a slightly easier conversation to have for them to be able to go, all right, in that case, well, we can tick that box, or we can move that policy, or we can scrap that, whatever it could be. And I think that idea that light that we talk about, the chinks light shining through, that's what breaks the stigma down, that people go, oh yeah, and then this is the thing. But I imagine then there'll be people maybe even serving in the military go, what? But what if there's an explosion and then there is a blood? And I guess then it's up to the people in authority to then go, well, actually, it's this. And then they educate those people. And I think that becomes a thing where everyone becomes educated, even those who aren't directly affected by it. And that's how we learn. That's how we do things. That's how people talk. And that's how a community responds to a situation. It takes on what is a perceived threat. It understands what that perceived threat is and passes on the appropriate either warnings or puts forward those other messages, which are, oh, actually, this is something which we've got a strategy for, we've got a policy for, it's being dealt with, you don't need to worry about it. And I think the idea that the community can be part of that solution is a strong one, isn't it?
Precisely. It definitely is a community sort of effort. And you know what? I don't blame anyone who has stigmatizing views on themselves. I think, of course, there is work to be done for people that hold stigmatizing views. But I think it's just about catching up. It's that community effort, like you say. If, for example, it would be absolutely amazing if we had a huge public health campaign on Can't Pass It On and U equals U, and everyone knew that people living with HIV can't pass the virus on if they're on effective treatment. However, I don't know everything about diabetes, and I don't know everything about sort of illnesses that don't affect me. And I don't think you should expect everyone to know everything. So of course you're going to get these little bubbles, but like you say, it's the people in authority. It's making sure that when these conversations do come up, we're appropriately telling people the correct information, and we're making sure that the information that they might have from, say, the 80s, from Freddie Mercury, from the Tombstone, are corrected and called out and not allowed to sort of persist, because it's not the truth anymore.
I think, Judge, with people like yourself sort of telling the truth and living your truth as well, I think we'll be part of that journey forward. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your time, Mick.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.